I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. You know, there's something tricky about ever feeling like you've heard enough Holocaust stories. I say it's tricky because we absolutely must not forget this part of history, and yet there is a kind of fatigue, I'm going to call it. It can set in when you feel you've reached a point of saturation, but saturation is not suffering. And empathizing with people who have suffered, that remains an eternal moral task for us to perform. Our next guest here on the show reached a point in his life after focusing year after year after year on the professional retelling of Holocaust stories. He reached a point when he wanted to immerse himself in a bit more light, more hope, more renewal. And fortunately, he found a way to do that without abandoning this moral task of remembrance. I want to introduce you to Joshua M. Green. He has a new book out titled Unstoppable: Sigi Wilsig's Astonishing Journey from Auschwitz Survivor and Penniless Immigrant to Wall Street Legend. Green is a well-known lecturer and author on Holocaust history and a maker of documentaries on the subject. And here he is to tell the tale of Sigi and also the tale of the book. Joshua Green, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Marcus. That may have been the most concise and impressive introduction I've ever had, so I thank you for that.
Well, was it accurate is the main thing about you?
It was. It was very accurate, and I think you've captured a kind of an existential place that I've been in for quite some time.
So the fatigue thing, you took on a book like this in spite of your initial reluctance.
That's a good way of putting it. At first, when the son of the protagonist in this biography approached me, I did everything possible to dissuade him. You know, saying, I'm not the guy for the job. I'm done with this. It's too dark. I don't want to go there again. He was very persuasive. His name is Ivan Wilsig. That was 8 years ago, and it's been quite a journey. He introduced me to his father's legacy. His father had passed away by then, but I read the transcript of his testimonies for the Steven Spielberg Shoah Foundation, and then some other transcripts of lectures he'd given, and read something of his background and realized, goodness, this is not what I'm accustomed to. This is something different. There's something in here for me, and this is a story worth telling.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it this way. I want to hear the shoelace out of tree bark story.
Yeah, you go right to the high points there. Here, imagine the situation, Marcus. Here's this short guy. Sigi was never more than 5 feet 5 inches. And as a teenager in Auschwitz, he was even shorter. In January of 1945, the Nazis march any remaining prisoners who were still alive out on a death march. They had to move them away from Poland, where Auschwitz was, because Soviet Union armies, the Russian armies, were approaching from the east. So they marched the prisoners to camps deeper inside Nazi territory. It's a freezing cold winter, January of 45, and young Sigi has threadbare clothes, and his shoes are wooden, like Dutch clogs, with shoelaces that have deteriorated in the rain and the mud. If he loses his shoes, he would die. All that you needed was a little infection, and your body, after having been starved for so long, had absolutely zero defense against that kind of infection. So he had to figure out what to do. One night on this death march from Auschwitz to Mauthausen, another concentration camp, as the Nazi guards bed their prisoners down in the snow for the night, young Sigi sees, he's 17 at this point, he sees a tree, a birch tree, and the only thing he has in his pocket from Auschwitz is a spoon. He had carved the edge of the spoon, a sharp medallion, on a stone so it could cut things. And he had this idea. And he was a very devout fellow, even as a boy, and said this is the kind of idea that only the Almighty could have put in someone's head. He went over to this little tree and he scored strips of bark, rubbed them between his hands to warm them up. Then he braided them together and created shoelaces out of these barks of the birch tree and tied them around his shoes and took some ginger steps, and sure enough, it held. That's, I think, a kind of metaphor for this man's life. He never gave in to despair. He always looked for that little spark, that little hint of something that can lift you out of danger, out of helplessness. And for him, at that moment, there was strips of bark from a tree.
So where he goes from that point in life, the story forward, takes us all the way into the days when he is a powerful financier on Wall Street. How do you tell a story like this and somehow prevent it from becoming a prototypical rags to riches story? Because there's so many of those. This is more than that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, insightful question. It was a danger. Look, here's what happened. He arrives in America after having joined the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, hunting down Nazis as a way of thanking his liberators for saving his life. 2 years later, he arrives in America, 1947, at age 21. He's got no money, no education. Schools had been closed to Jews by 1936 or so. He has no contacts, no business sponsors, or anything like that. But he sees that Americans are entrepreneurial, and he makes vows that he'd never go hungry again, that he would raise a Jewish family and support the Jewish people, and always speak up whenever he saw injustice. His first jobs were shoveling snow for a dollar a day, then cleaning toilets in sweatshops in downtown New York, graduates to selling ties, takes whatever little commissions he's earning, and teaches himself how to buy stock. He reads the financial papers and trains himself and picks up on this little sleepy oil and gas company in Texas, starts buying some stock, eventually leads a takeover of this Texas oil company, then turns his attentions to banking because to expand his oil company, he needed a flow of cash. Where do you get cash? In a bank. So he goes to a New Jersey bank and does the same thing, buys a little bit of stock, grows it, eventually takes over Trust Company of New Jersey. And by the time he was done, years later, he passed away in 2003, he had built a business empire, Marcus, with more than $4 billion in assets. Yeah. This is from a guy who had no formal education, you know.
Indulge me, just a stereotype here. I'm sorry, it is a stereotype. People that do this kind of thing are talkers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're talkers because without the education, without the connections, without the network of people, you've got to be convincing and persuasive, and that means you're going to do a lot of talking.
Siggy Wilzig was such a talker, other talkers seem silent by comparison. this was a guy who, remember, he's a shrimp of a guy. That's his word. He called himself a shrimp of a guy with flat feet, would win customers over to his bank, for example, growing his bank one customer at a time. He loved that. He was very proud of that. Not through mergers and acquisitions like most banks today. But he would wave tall tales and create such incredible stories that you had no choice but to believe him. Who would make up such things? I'll give you an example. A woman comes into one of his banks, and she's standing around the lobby, and he goes over and he starts primping her hair with his fingers, like he's Vidal Sassoon or somebody. And the woman's like, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Madam, I'm the bank president, and we own a whole chain of beauty salons. You know, you're very pretty. You're a very beautiful woman. I can make you even more beautiful, like a movie star." And she's getting all fascinated. And she says, "Oh, really? Can I get an appointment?" And he looks at her with this indignant expression, says, "Madam, we have no openings for the next 3 years." And he walks away in a huff. By the end of the day, she had given over to his bank all of her savings, all of her checking, all of her portfolio. He was that kind of persuasive personality. One person described him as someone who sucked the air out of a room. A little guy, but the 100 people I interviewed for this book all remember him as a giant of a personality.
So the title Unstoppable is apt.
very, very much so. You know, Forbes magazine did a profile of Siggy Wilczek, and they ended the profile by saying, you know, what's the Federal Reserve when you've stared down the Gestapo? You know, here's a guy, the Fed at one point tried to force him to divest, give up either his oil company or his banking company, because he said this is a conflict of interest. You were never formally trained in banking. You're putting your depositors' money at risk. So you can't divide your attention. You have to do one or the other. He sued the Federal Reserve, the first person in history to sue the Federal Reserve. I'm not going to give away what happened. I'd like people to read the book. But let's say that he was fearless. Nothing would stop him, not even the Federal Reserve, appointed by Congress to oversee the banking industry of the world's biggest democracy.
Here's what I'm grappling with right now. You've got this guy who has made his vows to do what he can for his people, to be good, to be a righteous being. That's the way I take it. And then he's a storyteller, and he will. I mean, it sounds a little bit, you know, like a loan shark kind of a situation. I just don't know. Is there a bridge there that you have to make?
Well, first thing, we're all storytellers. You tell stories for your listeners, and you tell good stories, and you give great interviews, so they listen. I think it's not so much a matter of is someone a storyteller, but what are their motives? You know, why are they doing what they're doing? In the law, you know, I do a lot of lectures to bar associations nationwide on war crimes trials and principles of justice in the aftermath of World War II. And in the courtroom, the person who wins is very often the lawyer who tells the better story. So telling stories is not in and of itself reprehensible or wrong. In Siggy's case, it was storytelling in service to a greater good. He never hurt anyone. His tall tales were meant to open a door to a conversation. You know, he wasn't the kind of banker who could say, oh, you belong to that golf club? I also belong to that golf club. Oh, you went to Harvard Business School? Oh, I went to Harvard. There was none of that. And he knew that most people had no idea of the horrors that had taken place in the Holocaust. So he had to find some way of connecting with them. And for him, the way he did it was being this very, very entertaining guy. He loved his life. He loved engaging with people. He would get up sometimes in restaurants when he was out to dinner with his family and start singing and dancing, you know, in the middle of the restaurant, you know, to dream the impossible dream. And people would be poking his children, saying, does he own the restaurant? They'd say, no, he just loves his life, Peter. So he would do it for a good reason, you know, namely that people had no idea what had occurred. And by getting a connection with them through these outrageous ways, he was mesmerizing. Then that's the opening of the door. Now he can tell you, do you see this number on my arm? I've been inside the worst that humanity has to offer. Let me tell you why I love my life so much and why I want to do good for you and for me and for everyone. It was a way of opening that door.
Siggy Wilczek, a giant on Wall Street who survived Auschwitz, and he is somebody who at one time said he could not abide that old axiom, there's no such thing as a free lunch. We're going to talk about Siggy Wilczek, his relationship to free lunches and food, after a short break as we visit with Joshua M. Green about his book, Unstoppable, Siggy B. Wilczek's Astonishing Journey from Auschwitz Survivor and Penniless Immigrant to Wall Street Legend. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Joshua M. Green is author of Unstoppable, Siggy B. Wilczek's Astonishing Journey from Auschwitz Survivor and Penniless Immigrant to Wall Street Legend. Joshua, what about that saying, there's no such thing as a free lunch? That would make him bristle, apparently.
He had an objection to the idea of doing good for good's people who objected to doing good for good's sake, as if anything that you do, it has to have some kind of kickback to you, some benefit for you. That was not his philosophy of life. Remember, this was someone who had lived under conditions that we cannot imagine, where a scrap of rotten bread or a bowl of rotten cabbage soup, which is not fit to give animals, was how he lived for 2 years in Auschwitz. He had seen the worst of humanity, you know, the horrors and tortures and humiliations on a scale that truly those of us who were not there cannot possibly understand. We can try to imagine, but we cannot actually understand it. And so for him, an act of charity was a gift from God, an opportunity to do something for someone else that's worth living for. And in his case, because he was such an insightful businessman, he would help people by giving them loans, even if they didn't have sufficient collateral to secure those loans. He would reach out to, if he saw one of his tellers in the bank sniffling, he would go over and say, what's the matter? Are you sick? What's happening? And he would send that person with his chauffeur-driven car to his personal doctor that they should get good attention. Or if, as happened one time, the son of one of his employees was suicidal. And Siggy, who did not have time for anything other than the business, took the day off and went to this man's home and sat and talked with his son. Why are you so sad? What's happening with you? He thrilled at the opportunity to do some good for others. And he knew it would come back to him, that kind of generosity. Of course, he hoped that when it came to their banking needs, they would think of him. Of course, he thought of that. But it wasn't a greedy motive that energized his charity.
So he was a people person. He wasn't just an individualist, kind of doing his own thing to advance his own career. He really cared about people, you're saying.
I don't think money was the object for him. I think money was the means for him. You know, a guy who had lived so close to the edge of death, who had nothing for so long, you know, the first 30, 40 years of his life had so little that money was the way to build a platform where he could speak and others would listen. You have to understand, Holocaust education for him was what his life was all about. He wanted people to understand that the Holocaust is not ancient history. Look, Marcus, you may remember the footage from January 6th, you know, the storming of the Capitol.
Of course.
There were people, at least one man that I can remember, with a sweatshirt with the words Camp Auschwitz printed on it. You know, anti-Semitism and hatred didn't die with Hitler in his bunker. You know, it's alive and well and growing tragically. And Siggy wanted people to be alert to this. He used to say, don't think that this doesn't concern you because you're not Jewish. This is not about being Jewish. This is about the world wanting someone to be responsible for them not getting what they think they deserve. And they're going to blame somebody. So today it's the Jews. Tomorrow it'll be some other minority, some other underrepresented community. So speak up when you see wrong being done. You know, don't be a bystander. Be an upstander.
Do you ever wish that you had a chance in person to hear him speak in public?
Oh, often. Yeah. Fortunately, some of his lectures, a few, two or three, were videotaped. So I got a chance to see this guy in action, and man, was he a powerhouse. He knew when to raise a hand and when to raise a finger to make a point. He knew when to make his voice very soft to get the point across. He knew when to grab the sides of the podium, when to lean forward to engage his audience in what he was trying to say. You know, you do not have the imagination to imagine even what it was like. And, I mean, it was very dramatic.
Family life? Was he a family guy?
He was. He lived for family. He lived for raising his children as devout Jews, as practicing Jews. He lived to support the Jewish community. You can't come through the kind of extreme trauma that Sigi Wilczek lived through undamaged. It's a long discussion about what it's like for children of victims of extreme crime or victims of trauma or genocide, what it's like for their offspring, family, to live with that.
Yeah, you could even have a big conversation about epigenetics and the idea that that carries on, the damage.
Yeah, it's a controversial field, Marcus, but you're right to bring it up. The notion for your listeners who may not be aware, epigenetics is a relatively new field in psychology, which says that the effects of trauma can be transmitted across generations even without any direct channel of that information coming across. For example, your grandparents may have gone through some trauma, and there will be a genetic imprint that was made on your parents and from them to you, so that even though you're two generations removed from the source of that trauma, there can still be some transmission. And it's been documented to a certain extent that there are certain changes within the chromosomes damaged by trauma.
But there's also the aspect of nurture, and as a father with children, he's going to want to shape his children or give them a leg up or impress upon them certain values, and do you suppose he did that well?
He did. Of course he did. That was, you know, one of the things that the children of, whether it's Holocaust survivors or other extreme tragedies, discover is that they're miracle children, you know, in the eyes of their father or mother, whoever came out of that situation, they're miracles. The parents will think of them as gifts from God. You know, I came through this, and now you're here, you know, and I, there's nothing I wouldn't do for you. He wanted his children, of course, to understand the history, and sometimes when it's your own parent, it's an extremely difficult thing to hear. So there were some stories that he didn't even talk about with his children. I learned about them listening to his testimony for the Steven Spielberg Shoah Foundation, which was recorded just 2 or 3 months before he passed away at the end of 2002. And there are stories that his children tell me they never heard before.
Well, once again, let's focus on the wide chasm between that terrible time and then a time of plenty and prosperity. I mean, you write about him serving people pyramids of bagels, trays of smoked salmon and whitefish, platters piled high with pastrami, corned beef, turkeys. I mean, he enjoyed showing some hospitality to people, and I just can't imagine one would find that kind of experience completely divorced from his history. Just somewhere in the back of his mind, he's always thinking, this didn't have to be, and it's a miracle that it ever was.
Yeah, no, that's very insightful on your part. He was surviving on scraps in the concentration camps, and the opportunity to provide customers and guests to his offices with a feast was, you know, kind of an ultimate revenge on Hitler.
Yeah.
It was his way of saying, well, it also, I guess your final solution didn't quite work out the way you'd hoped.
Yeah.
You know, we're still here and we're doing quite well. Thank you very much. Sure, that was a real pleasure for him to be able to turn that table around.
You used the word platform a little earlier, the idea that he achieved a platform for saying what he was wanting to say in life. And ultimately, that led him to involvement with the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
On holidays, the few holidays that he ever took, he brought his family to the Saxony Hotel in Miami because pleasant, warm weather. And the Saxony was a kosher hotel, meaning that they served kosher food, and it was a favorite place for Jewish holiday goers. And one year, in the, I guess it was mid-70s, he was having dinner in the hotel dining room, and at the table next to him was the Auschwitz survivor and Nobel Prize winner, Elie Wiesel, with his family. And they struck up a conversation, and they had both been through Auschwitz, and so they became friends. And when President Reagan appointed Wiesel the commissioner for building a Holocaust museum in Washington, Wiesel turned to Sigge, because Wiesel did a lot of things and was a marvelous writer, but didn't know the first thing about business or finance. So he asked Sigge, "I need your help. Will you come to Washington and help me build this museum?" And he did. He reformed their financial practices. He reformed their hiring practices. And he was very instrumental on the museum council, resolving complex issues of, you might call them, curatorial or editorial direction. What kind of museum should this be? Should it be a Jewish museum and closed on the Sabbath? Should it be an American museum and emphasize the role of the Allies in liberating the camps and winning the war? Should it be a museum that showed stacks of human hair and prosthetic limbs, as happened in the memorial museums at some of the camps in Germany, or was that going to be too traumatic, especially for young visitors? Should the words of Hitler be put on the walls, or should that be reserved for, let's say, a quote from Anne Frank, "Despite everything, I still believe in the goodness of people"? There were a lot of issues. The most controversial of all, Marcus, was whether this should be exclusively about the Jewish dimension of the Holocaust, or whether other minorities should be represented. The Jews were not the only people picked out for being terrorized and murdered, but they were the only people targeted for total annihilation. So it was a big debate, and Sigge was firm that every time you step away from the Jewish specificity of the Holocaust, it gets easier and easier and easier to move farther and farther away until, frankly, it becomes revisionist history. So he was adamant about that.
I want to have a conversation here finally with you about something that I think is the most challenging of all that comes from his story. And, you know, I was trained at one time to think in terms of something called theodicy, you know, the philosophical question, mm-hmm. Theological question of why it is that people suffer. And in under that rubric, Sigge at one time said, or even had written as a creed in his office, engraved, I think, "Free men who forget their bitter past do not deserve a bright future." And then one more thing. He once said, "I don't think I could live without my nightmares. I would never, ever give that up for anything in the world." This is mind-bending stuff, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, you've done your homework here. Look, you just raised one of the grand challenges in the history of human civilization. How do we reconcile the notion of a purposeful, God-centered universe with evil? How can there both be goodness and evil in the same worldview? How do those two things cohabit the same creation? I want to tell you a story. I'm going to answer you with a little story, a little anecdote about Sigge. During his time with the Counterintelligence Corps after the liberation of Camp Mauthausen, remember, he's still just a young guy, I think 18, 19 years old. He's hunting Nazis, and his job took him on his first airplane ride. And it was a cold, cloudy, rainy day. And he got on the plane, the plane took off, and it rose through the cloud bank and burst through into the other side. And Siggy's pupils dilated, seeing on the other side of the clouds bright, beautiful sky and a shining sun. And he said, "In that moment, my faith in God was reaffirmed." You know, he said, in Auschwitz, there was this big question. Is there a God still? Was there ever a God? Some people said he's abandoned us. Other people said, well, he set the universe in motion and then split. He's not around anymore. Other people lost their faith and said he never was there. Siggy never lost his faith, but that incident, that moment of breaking through the clouds and seeing that bright, beautiful sky, he said, in that moment, God was speaking to me. And he was saying, you know, don't despair. Sometimes a cloud like Hitler comes between us, but I'm still here. I'm still here.
Joshua Green is author of Unstoppable, Siggy B. Wilsig's Astonishing Journey from Auschwitz Survivor and Penniless Immigrant to Wall Street Legend. Joshua Green, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcus.
Siggy Wilsig triumphed over the darkness of Auschwitz. He later became wealthy, did not lose his humanity. Those two things together, that's no small task. Now, believe it or not, we're going to match the mood of that story with another story brought to the whole world about the whole world from NASA. Do you remember the scene when Siggy Wilsig's airplane rises above the clouds and he experiences the wonder of creation? That moment is a perfect match for the story of the Earthrise photograph of 1968. We'll tell that story next here on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Another feel-good story for you. This one not about the triumph of a single person, but in a way it's the triumph of the human race, or at least a rallying point for a world that back in 1968 was as bitterly divided, you could say, as our world today. It's about an image that gave us all a rare chance to see how much beauty we all have in common. It's about the famous Earthrise photo taken in 68 by the astronauts on Apollo 8. I visited with Emmanuel Von Lee, an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and director of Earthrise, the image that shared our world. Here's part of the conversation, and we begin noting that NASA never had any plan to capture that famous photo.
There was never a real plan from NASA to take images of the Earth from space. This is something you hear all the astronauts share in the film, is that they had no directive to take pictures of the Earth, to take pictures of the Earthrise. They were there to test the viability of a future moon landing, to see if they could actually survive a voyage to the moon. Could they orbit the moon? Could they take some images of the surface of the moon that could be future landing sites? But there was never any directive, any instruction from NASA to say, hey, turn the camera around, take a picture of Earth because we want to see what we look like. You know, as Jim Lovell says in the film, we were all on the Earth, so we thought we knew about the Earth, which to me was such a telling statement, you know, the hubris that we had back then in 68, that we just thought we knew everything about where we were and who we were because we were on the Earth. And that's, again, I think what made this image so profound is it just captured in a single frame exactly who we are. So, it was not a planned image in any way. And if you listen to the audio recording of that moment, because NASA had tape rolling the entire time during the mission, you hear them literally go, oh my gosh, look at that photo. We got to get that. Get me the color film quick. Oh, you know, they're just in the moment, you know, struck by this vision of awe and grandeur and doing their best to capture it. So to me, the fact that it was an accident just underscored the importance of telling this story, because it shows how easy it is to just to have blinders on, looking forward motion. We're going to do the next best thing. We're going to conquer the moon. We're going to conquer Mars. We're going to just keep on going forward, that kind of drive that has become almost our mantra as humanity, and that we forget to look back and we forget to pay attention to the ground beneath our feet. And so, you know, 50 years later, one of my hopes for sharing this film is that it reminds us the importance of slowing down and remembering where we've come from and who we are. And that means looking back to this iconic moment.
You know, I kind of wonder if we had just sent some sort of remote-controlled orbiter out there, no humans on board, if we had just sent something up there where it could have captured the very same image, you know, I wonder if it would have been as profound as kind of living by proxy through those astronauts and experiencing the shock, the amazement in that moment through those voices that are recorded as they themselves realize for the first time that they're seeing something utterly spectacular. You know what I'm saying? If it were unmanned, have you ever thought about that?
I've thought about that a lot, and you know, we see so many images, you know, beamed down from the International Space Station now, which are taken digitally without a human being behind them. And for me, at least, they don't have the same kind of connection as when I see an astronaut on the space station who's taken that image purposefully, framing something with an emotional connection to the subject matter. And I think that's part of why we connect to this image, and of course, because we know a human being took it. And it was a human being who was looking down above, and we could relate to that human being. We can't relate to a machine. Or, you know, that's the thing. When we see an image that was taken by a human being that was there, we can feel and connect to that experience because we know somebody else took it. I don't think that's just an isolated experience related to the Earth, or I think it's something that makes photography so powerful, is that, you know, you could have unmanned drone footage of a war zone, but you can have a human capturing that image, and it's going to be a very different experience because there's an act of witnessing that is part of that. And I think we as human beings, we can relate to that act of witnessing, of observing something and participating in something. And that's what makes these moments so powerful, when we get to participate vicariously or by a proxy through someone like Bill Anders.
You know, I have to come clean and tell you why I wanted to talk to you and talk about Earthrise right now as we're coming up on the 50th anniversary. To me, it seems like that moment in history was pivotal. And you kind of hint at this in the documentary, or at least the words of the astronauts hint in this direction. I don't know that the documentary necessarily says everything there is to say about how Earth Day came about and how the environmental movement took off as a result of this photo. But it's almost as though as we approach the 50th anniversary, that when the day comes, December 24th? Is it 24th?
Correct, yeah.
When that comes on a Christmas Eve, that the event of the anniversary risks getting the same kind of treatment that media is notorious for doing. It's going to get short shrift. You know, it'll be news that morning. Everyone will talk about it for a little while, and then it'll just go away. It's not going to have that same stunning impact on society that happened internationally. I mean, these astronauts, they went around the globe, and they took the photo. They even went to Russia, and they were with heads of state, and they were speaking before Congress. This was one of those moments in history that I don't even have the right adjective for. You can't say it's a seismic or tectonic plate shift, but it's mind-bending to think of what happened then, and I'm afraid it's going to get short shrift on the anniversary now.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the word you were looking for is like paradigm shifting. I mean, that photo had that effect. It shifted our perspective, our consciousness, you know, on a global level for the first time. You know, this was, you know, you've got to remember when that, not just the image was taken, but when they broadcast on Christmas Eve a message from the moon where you actually saw the Earth from, you know, that very old, shaky TV footage that was beamed down. You know, it was being received by a billion people who were having that experience with them of seeing that, and they connected to the astronauts' experience, and this image comes out and it shifts their perspective. And yeah, Frank Borman says in the film that he felt like for a moment we were connected as a human family, as global citizens, but then, you know, we got back to business as usual. And yes, I agree, you know, 50 years later, chances are there'll be anniversary op-eds and there'll be statements made about how we can remember the photograph and its significance as we deal with ecological and social and political upheaval. But chances are, a week later, it'll be, you know, after Christmas sales, which most people are, you know, putting their attention to. You know, and I was actually at NASA last week screening the film there. And after the screening, they asked me a question. They said, "What do you think the next Earthrise moment is?" You know, and here I was in front of an audience full of engineers working on the Orion program to bring man to the moon. And I said, I don't think we need another Earthrise moment. I think we need to actually really begin to remember and embody what this moment offered us. And so for me, one of the hopes of making this film is that when that 50th anniversary rolled around, it wasn't just going to be, let's, you know, reflect on this, say how great it was, let's look at the image and reflect on it, but can we actually really connect to that moment and embody it and take that with us and not try and move on to the next thing?
And just for clarification, the Orion program going on now has what aim?
To go to Mars.
To go to Mars. Okay. And that's where this is so striking, that you would have the gall, that you would have the audacity to say to these engineers, the program you're working on to take us to Mars, that is not going to be the next paradigm shift because we haven't even properly processed the first one that we should have.
Yeah, that's my feeling, you know, and that seemed to be a feeling that was echoed by the Apollo 8 astronauts. The, you know, Bill Anders says in the film, one of the closing statements of the film is that, you know, he hears people talk about going to Mars, and he doesn't think we should go to Mars until we get our act together here on Earth first, not as Americans or Russians or Chinese, but as human beings. I find that very poignant because we're still stuck in so many of the same identity politics, identity situations that we were back then, where we are thinking about our own national interests and not the interests of the Earth as a whole.
That Frank Borman segment that you were referring to, it was so striking I had to write it down from the documentary. He said, "I may be naive, but I think that we will eventually, through the space program and through this space exploration, away from the Earth and away from the totally nationalistic interests, we may in some way develop a closer relationship here among the people. I firmly believe that." He says that. Now, I think that was early in, that was soon after the mission.
That was a month or two after the mission. That was part of this Face the Nation interview where the three astronauts are being interviewed for national broadcast, and I think it was really just a few weeks after their experience. They were fresh and still completely immersed in what had happened to them and the impact that it was having on, you know, NASA, the U.S., and the world as a whole. So at that moment, Frank is completely filled with possibility, as was Bill and Jim, and I think so many people around the world, which is why it had that tremendous, momentous effect that led to the EPA being created, led to the first Earth Day, had this tremendous catalytic type effect for the environmental movement. But, you know, a couple years go by and people start to forget.
Yeah. This forgetfulness is just stunning to me. And here we are now in a day and age when these issues of what does it mean to have an Earth, what does it mean to have to be positioned on this little speck, on this little tiny blue marble out in space? What will its future be? I can't imagine a greater coincidence than the convergence of a documentary like this with the 50th anniversary, with where we are now in the global discourse about the future of Earth. Do you ever sit back and think, wow, I'm right at the crossroads of where all the discussions are happening that really matter, and I've got this historic 50th anniversary to celebrate. I mean, you've got to think about that, I'm sure.
Well, I think there are many storytellers like myself who are trying to find moments in our history, moments in our unfolding history that's happening right now that can be used to point us to a way of seeing ourselves and each other in the kind of perspective that the photograph offered 50 years ago. So I don't think I'm alone there. I think, you know, that there is a need right now for artists, storytellers, you know, to really try and use the power of story to remind us what's important, is to connect us to this broader sense of identity of who we are and where we've come from, because we struggle to just grasp it. And until we understand it, I think we're going to need more and more stories. So as effective as I want this film to be, I think it's not going to be effective if it's alone. It has to be joined by the voices and stories of many others.
Iconic. That's, I feel so stupid even saying that, because you can't find the right words for a photo like this. And if just anybody were to take it, I mean, just go to Wikipedia and look the thing up and take just 60 seconds to look at this image and then feel what you might feel in that moment. You're going to be right where those astronauts are, feeling the, I think, very close to the same feelings. It's kind of this existential fear. A sublime feeling of how small we are. And the astronauts themselves referred to this over and over again, that suddenly they felt that the Earth was so small that everything that they felt that was near and dear to them was on that little speck. There is a story here of tension and exposure to risk that's really understated, I think, in the documentary that you make, because we get to hear them talk about that smallness. Emmanuel, if you would just address this smallness issue, because I think that's like the complication of the plot that makes you feel sick in your stomach while you're watching the documentary.
Yeah, it's something they all described in their own way in the interviews, is just how small the Earth really was when you got out there at 240,000 miles. And then, of course, how small it made them feel. You know, and for Bill Anders, it was actually a moment that shifted his identity to the core. He was a Catholic, and he said that after he made this voyage, he could no longer necessarily hold some of his religious values in the same way. It kind of shook him to the core. The Earth was not the center of the universe. And he struggled with religious identity ever since, and has become much more atheistic since then. So, you know, that moment of seeing how small, and then, of course, how fragile the Earth is, just shifted them. And that's what I think shifted us as well, because we saw it as so small. But at the same time, it's still home. You know, when you think of these other iconic, use the word you have, iconic images of Earth in, that have come out, you know, like the pale blue dot, you know, from Voyager, you know, it's still home. It's just a pale blue dot, but it's still home. And the further we get, the more that it feels like it's home, you know, and the more important it gets to us. And so I think it just brings out that primal feeling that we all have of the Earth is our home, and we get away from it. It's like, I want to get back there. I want to get back to my family. I want to get back to my loved ones. I want to get back to what I care about. Now, what I think would be really interesting is if we can broaden that away just from our own family and our own immediate surroundings, but to embrace the idea of Earth as home and love it the same way that we do our families.
Well, this is moving in the direction of that famous piece by Archibald MacLeish that appeared, was it in the New York Times, 1968?
The 25th. He wrote, the day after their broadcast, he wrote this op-ed piece or little piece inspired by the broadcast that included this poem, Riders on the Earth.
Well, he begins it with a sentence. He says, men's conception of themselves and of each other has always depended on their notion of the Earth, this notion of the Earth. And then if I compare that with what one of the astronauts had to say, one of the astronauts said, he said, I personally thought that everyone would like to have that view, to see the Earth as it really is. I think this Archibald MacLeish piece is just so vitally important to the entire story. The astronauts, in fact, the astronaut speaking before Congress recited at length directly from this. He quoted directly from this. Men's conception of themselves and of each other has always depended on their notion of the Earth, writes MacLeish. When the Earth was the world, all the world there was, and the stars were lights in Dante's heaven, and the ground beneath men's feet roofed hell, they saw themselves as creatures at the center of the universe, the sole particular concern of God, and from that high place they ruled and killed and conquered as they pleased. MacLeish goes on to explain how this paradigm shift really did happen for people that weekend. It's really remarkable when you think about it, that he was able to internalize what was going on, internalize the impact of the image and of this space flight, and then see such a paradigm shift within 24 hours time and write in these terms about this space flight of Apollo 8. He goes on to say that if we're not at the center of the universe, then where do we imagine that we are? And if we're not the primary focus of all in the universe, surely that's going to have religious implications for many, many people. He concludes his essay saying, to see the Earth as it truly is, small and beautiful, blue and beautiful, in the eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who know now that they are truly brothers. I like language, and I've never hidden this from anybody, that I just love poetry, and I love well-written things like this. For Archibald MacLeish to talk about the bright loveliness in the eternal cold, that image of Earth, and the black nothingness. Again, may I just encourage you to look for that image, look it up. And as I think about my kids and other people seeing this documentary, I'm wondering how you achieved what I think is really a remarkable thing. There is a universal something that just hits you, no matter what age you are, I think, and it lets you know that this photograph, Earthrise, has political and environmental and even existential implications. I don't know how anybody could miss the point of the photo. Do you?
No, I really don't. You know, that's what makes it so surprising, that it's lost some of its gravitas for people, perhaps because it's just been so, you know, ubiquitous that people will go, oh, yeah, it's that photograph, but they forget the story that goes with it, or they didn't know the story that goes with it, and they forget the implications of what it had, and it just becomes a point in history, you know, text in a book, a date on a calendar, but not this really monumentous shift that it could be and should be.
Yeah. Have you been going the rounds trying to revive interest in the photo? I mean, clearly that's what the documentary is about. But I mean, have you been proactively like going the circuit and giving lectures?
No. The film has been, you know, screening at festivals and events. And I go and share the film and talk about, you know, the film with audiences. But No, I actually haven't said, you know, we need to, you know, to get this photograph out there more and more. I'm more interested in what the story can remind in us, which is not just about the photograph, which is what this photograph prompted in us to get, you know, back then. You know, can we return to that feeling of love and awe and grandeur and wonder? You know, I feel like we live in a wonder-deprived world. You know, yes, there's wondrous images on our Instagram feeds at all times, but they don't seem to evoke wonder in the way that this photo did. And can we somehow connect to that sense of wonder and awe and find a way to make it stick? That's the question I have. I don't have an answer, but it's the question I have. And one of the reasons I made the film is because I wanted to find a way to make a film that would ask that question, that wouldn't just, you know, say, hey, this is a monumentous moment in time. This is a powerful photograph. Let's talk to the people who went to, or, you know, went to the moon for the first time. But can that story kind of evoke something in us?
I like that phrase, to make it stick, that you just used, to make the sense of awe and wonder stick. Are you good at it sometimes? Not all the time, but are you good at it sometimes?
On good days.
On good days?
I think it'd be a lot better. You know, I think it's one of the things I think it's challenging right now is we have so many distractions that take us away of just sitting in wonder. You know, 50 years ago, there were a billion people watching and listening to this moment. You know, there aren't too many times nowadays we have a billion people doing anything at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think to have a billion people share in wonder or awe, that's one way to make it stick. But I think, you know, we just have to find ways in our own lives, given the distractions that we're overloaded with, to kind of carve out space to be in a space of remembrance and awe and wonder for what the photo represents, which is home. And again, go back to what I said earlier, I really feel that one of the messages, if you will, the film has is that Earth is home, both in the macro sense as a planet from 240,000 miles away, but also in a micro sense with, you know, the home that we have, whatever that is. It's an apartment, it's a house, but it's also what's around it. It's the people around it. It's the Earth around it. It's the gardens that we can care for. And can we keep on expanding that sense of home?
Emmanuel Vaughn Lee is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and director of Earthrise, The Image That Shared Our World. Get ready for the last big weekend of summer. We're headed into Labor Day, which will be Monday. And tomorrow, on our show, everything you need for your Labor Day feast. Well, maybe not everything, but certainly beef and regional hamburgers are important to Americans in summertime. And we'll also look at condiments, mustard, vinegar, and grease. Indeed, grease has been styled a condiment. We'll meet the fellow who said that. A Labor Day bash tomorrow on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.